Welcome to the fire.
Welcome to the fire, boys. My name is Parker McDonald.
And I'm Walter Lee, and we'll be your hosts on this episode of the Southern Collective Hunting Podcast. If you're a new hunter trying to learn the basics,
or you're a veteran woodsman just trying to get through your workday, there's always a place at our campfire for you.
Speaking of the fire, we would love it if you guys would join our growing Patreon community and be a part of the best and only digital deer camp south of Mason-Dixon Line.
Come on. If you'd like to learn more, click on the link in the show notes. But for now, Walt,
welcome to the fire. All right, everybody. Welcome to the first inaugural episode of Florida Fridays here on the Southern Collective. If you're not part of the Patreon community, you probably don't know what this is or why it's in your feed, and it probably doesn't resonate with you yet. And I think it will. When Parker and I merged, I had a very Florida-centric listener base, and we have carried on a lot of the traditions of the Chasing Tales Outdoor podcast in the form of community and the Patreon community, but also the Hunt Camp community. And the idea that was born across both the Southern Collective and Chasing Tales Outdoors was the idea that there was a need for community in the outdoor space. Some would say like a safe space, and obviously that has a negative connotation, but I mean it more in the sense of like a space where positivity wins, where mentorship wins, where lifelong friendships and memories are made. That was something that a lot of us grew up with. And so we took that model. I stumbled upon that with Chasing Tales Outdoors. I didn't wake up and just go, this is what I'm going to do. But you guys, the listeners, kind of showed me that there was a need for that. And we ended up leaning into it kind of inadvertently. And when we started the Southern Collective, there was a hard shift. We went from nearly Florida-centric content to probably an 80-20 split. And I know for a lot of you guys, that was a bit of a shock. Both if you're from the state of Florida, you really enjoyed hearing about your state. But also I think, and we're going to talk about this some, I'm sure, this podcast, that the skill set that you hone in the state of Florida translates to other states better than the other way around, right? I believe, and I think a lot of people who've hunted here would agree that if you could be a diehard big buck killer, let's just use the low hanging fruit, in the state of Florida, you can take that to Alabama and probably have success. But if you're a diehard Alabama big buck hunter, you're probably going to struggle when you get to Florida because it's just a different environment. It's a different setup for just, you know, quotas and access and everything else. And so we heard a lot of feedback from you guys that you wanted to see more Florida content. And one of the ways we're going to remedy that until I have more time to focus on this as the company grows and as I'm able to do this with more and more of my time, we're going to start what's called Florida Fridays. And so once a month, we're going to produce a Florida specific episode that will punch into the tradition that was Chasing Tales Outdoors there for a while. And so I was tasked with trying to figure out who would be the inaugural guest. I cannot think of a more commiserate outdoorsman and advocate for this state than you, sir. In truth, it was a very short list of people I wanted to have on here from the start, and you were literally the number one person I wanted to start off. So we've got the legendary Travis Thompson of Cast and Blast, Florida Podcast, and All Florida. Dude, I really appreciate you carving time out because this is the third time we've tried to record.
So Florida Fridays, right?
Yeah.
So would I be remiss to start off with Go Gators?
You would not be remiss about.
Okay. I feel like that's the right way to start that, right? Like,
yeah,
I may have been seated by some of your Patreons and asked to go ahead and just give a shout out to the Gators right here off the top.
Oh, that's fitting. That's really fitting.
So, yeah. But, okay. And I'm not, I do root for the Gators, but I'm not a Gator guy. Actually,
yeah.
I think good of you. No, man, thank you for the kind words. Thank you for having me on. I think I was on Chasing Tales 84 years ago.
Yeah, it's been a minute. Way I was actually there. Trying to find that.
You sound like me trying to comb through the archives and find something from the old podcast days.
Yeah. You know, I did the math the other day. I've been podcasting for 7 years, and that hurts. I don't feel like I've been doing this that long.
Hey, time flies when you're having fun, right?
It does, man. It does. So here's my thinking. The state of Florida, is a unique paradise. We did a four-part series highlighting just really high level right before we merged. We did this four-piece series where we broke down the different types of areas to deer hunt. And I feel like we didn't do enough justice in that episode. We're going to take that series and build on that to come. I genuinely believe, and this may be subject to change in the future, but I genuinely believe Florida has got to be one of the best outdoorsman paradises. The ability to just go and always be able to do something in the country. What do you think about that?
Yeah. No, what is it? These are talking points I use on the conservation side all the time. Like, you can hunt something in Florida. Was it 9.5 months a year? Mm-hmm. Almost 10 months a year within the boundaries of the state. Like, archery season will open in the South Zone July 31st, I think, this year, mm-hmm. 30th or 31st. And between that, alligator season, then obviously all your normal duck, deer, turkey. Well, the last turkey you can hunt is the end of April in the North Zone. And so you're talking about May and June are really the only 2 months that you can't hunt any animal within the confines of that month. And then add in, like, there's extraordinary fishing, like 12 months a year, depending on what you want to catch, where you want to catch, where you're at in the state. I challenge anyone to find me a better, like, we both live more in the hunting side, like mm-hmm. on social media, I'd imagine. So you see your folks out west and they're done with their hunting season in September, October, because then they're just covered in snow and ice. And I'm like, wait, what are you guys doing now? It's great. It's different. But, I'm a fifth generation Floridian. To me, like, my family, they kind of get frustrated with me because I never want to go anywhere else. Like, we go on vacation, I want to go to the beach in Florida. We go on mm-hmm. vacation, I want to go to duck camp or turkey camp or deer camp. Like, that's how I grew up. That's how I was raised. And so everything I do is through a Florida-centric lens. So, yeah, I'm a biased person. Mm-hmm. But I completely agree with what you said. I mean, I went on a trip to Arkansas a few years back, and we hadn't pulled the trigger in 3 days, and we watched duck after duck after duck after duck go into these impoundments away from these blinds. And I'm like, dude, if I had like 3 palmettos and I can kill these ducks, like, give me a couple of decoys and 3 palmettos and I'll figure out how to kill these ducks. And they're like, no, that's not how we hunt. I'm like, well, doesn't seem like you're hunting. It seems like you're waiting. Mm-hmm. I think if you can do it in Florida, you can do it anywhere. Look at all the turkey guys. They come here, they go home empty handed. The Florida guys leave here, they go knock on a door in Tennessee and kill two mm-hmm. turkeys like 15 minutes later. Mm-hmm. So I'm okay with that. If some people want to throw shade at that, but I'll put Florida hunters up against any other hunter anywhere.
You know, what's funny is I have been trying for 4 years to get people who disagree with that to come down and do a swap. I'll take you to my best deer hunting spots, my best turkey hunting spots. I will drop you off with a roadmap and let's just see what happens. And then I'll come up and do the same thing up there, you know, in Ohio or PA or some of these different places. And I've got a couple of my buddies who are on the side. I've kind of called them out publicly and they're like on the side. They're like, dude, stop. Like, I can't come down there. Like, I'm going to get my teeth kicked in. I'm like, I know. And like, but I'm not going to stop calling you up because you're disagreeing with me publicly. And that's just good interaction. Right. But like, it's tough, dude. I'm that. So I grew up, I was born in Amelia Island, moved to Southeast Georgia, had 1800 acres of private land that my family had for generations, and I hunted and I had a blast. I moved to Tallahassee. It took me 4 years to kill a deer. I got my teeth kicked in. I mean, just my teeth kicked in. And the whole time I'm thinking, this doesn't feel any different than where I grew up, but it just was. It was so bizarre and strange, and the deer gravitate to different things. And I think Thomas Venuti on social media, you know, he punches his tags here, and then he's in Tennessee and he's in Alabama, and it just feels like he goes all over the place, and he never has any problem getting on deer. I mean, it's not that he doesn't work for it, but that skill set just translates.
If you can hunt here, you can hunt anywhere.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's hard to hunt here. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's, mm-hmm. it's hard. The only thing I think we're not prepared for is elevation changes.
Yeah.
Because you get winded faster other places. So I do think, like, I'll give like the Western guys, like, or even the Northern guys, like, sometimes they're a little bit better conditioned than sure. we are because it's flat everywhere here. But, yeah, that's about the only edge I'd give them.
And they definitely can't handle the humidity. I had a friend of mine come out from Colorado and stay with me for a little while. And it was like 75 degrees maybe that day. It was warm, but it wasn't hot, you know, and he's just like pouring sweat. And I had a whole cooler full of Gatorade and water not because of any reason other than I sweat a lot and I just want to stay hydrated. And he's like, dude, I can't thank you for buying these, but thank you for buying these. I'm like, okay. And he just keeps thanking me and he's pounding them just like I expected. We get done. We've walked like 4 or 5 miles in the woods looking for a turkey. We finally get done and we're on the way back and he's kind of in that like comatose, like gassed category, you know, where you're awake, but you're just kind of like alone with your mind. I said, did you think I bought that cooler stuff for you? Because I thought you'd be like in bad shape. Because yeah, I assume so. I was like, no, dude, that's a weekly grocery run that I make during the season. And it's just always in the back of the truck. And he looked at me like, you've got to be kidding me. I was like, no, man, I definitely get my butt kicked at 10,000 feet in Colorado, but it's not for heat conditioning. You know, it's just, I can't breathe. And he's like, I don't know how you do this. I said, add 30 degrees to it and let's have a conversation. You know, like.
Yeah. Come see me in early teal or July archery or an alligator. Like we buy liquid IV by the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like literally, I think I spent during duck season, I think I spent $300 on liquid IV for myself and my team.
Like I believe it.
Because you have to stay hydrated out there. Yep. And yeah, it's nice on those mornings when it's 58 degrees in a duck blind or whatever. But at noon, it's 88 and 100% humidity. Like moving blinds around and stuff, about to sweat to death.
Yeah. Or if you're still hunting in the wintertime, you know, up here on the panhandle, I see 18 to 25 degree lows. Pretty common. Like you have to have a gear set to accommodate it, right? But God forbid you got to move that day. Right. Because whatever's going to keep you warm in 15 mile an hour sustained winds and 22 degrees, if you're trying to drag a deer out or walk through the woods, you're probably going to be freezing your butt off because of just, it's just different, man. It's just, you hit the nail on the head, but
it's different. And our cold is different too. Our cold is a wet cold.
Oh yeah.
It like cold is cold to your bones.
Stings.
Yeah.
Yeah. It stings. Your fingers hurt. Yeah. When I went to Colorado, I've only been out one time. I'm going back out this year and I cannot wait, but I went out, elk hunting with my uncle and I get to the terminal and I'm sitting there, got my pack on, all this gear, and it's just cold. It feels so good. And he goes, hey man, I'm coming around the corner, but I'm just curious right now. What temperature do you think it is? I was like, I don't know, man, like 55, 56. And he just starts laughing. He goes, higher. And they keep going. I keep going. And he goes, step into the sun. I step into the sun and it's marginally warmer. I was like, I don't know, man, what, 61, 62? He goes, it's 83 degrees right now. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. He goes, yeah, it's dry. And that was when I realized there were like, maybe I need to put lotion on in this state, you know? But I was jealous. And they don't have a pollen issue out there. So
no.
But dude, so here's the deal. If we're going to paint this picture of the state of Florida being sportsman's paradise, with that comes obviously responsibility, peril. It should be no news to anybody here that there's a lot of people moving to the state of Florida. It's, you know, that's put in front of our face on a daily basis by a variety of elected officials who are really proud of that fact. We just came from Disney last week and we're driving down the road and we see the same six houses and the same six colors for about 40 miles. And we're sitting here like, what the heck is, like, this is insane. I've never seen it before. I've heard about it. Never seen it before. And then we come around the corner and all of a sudden there's the billboard. It's the Villages. And I realize the scope of some of the things I've been hearing now for quite some time. High level overview. The sportsman's paradise. Do you believe it's in peril? Are we in good shape? What's the state of the union of Florida, would you say?
Wow, that's a big question to answer in two sentences. But I will say, I think anything you care about is in peril as soon as you take it for granted. Mm-hmm. That's how I'll answer that question. That's the most succinct way I can put it. Anything you care about is in peril the second you take it for granted. And I do think we live in an instant gratification day and age. I mean, we see this in the hunting industry, the fishing industry all the time. Like, how can I make it easier to kill a bigger animal? How can I make it easier to catch more fish with less effort, less gas, less spend, better equipment, et cetera? And when we do that, we become more, this is Travis's opinion, we become more about commoditizing the game, the species, the take, the harvest, than we are about the experience. It took you 4 years to kill your first deer on public land. Like, that's hunting. Hunting is not walking out there every time and smoking an 8-point. Like that's just, I love it when that happens. Don't get me wrong, but that's not the act of hunting is pursuing the game, not killing the game. That's the act of killing or harvesting or whatever verb you want to use. And so, you know, I think a lot of us view it through that lens only. Mm-hmm. Success is me being able to go to the woods and shoot my ducks, my turkey, my deer. Success is me going to the water and catching my limit or my trophy or whatever, in the most efficient, effective manner possible that I can then turn around and share on social media. And I think that engenders some apathy for the work that we got to do to make sure this stuff is around long term. So, yes, we are a sportsman's paradise. Yes, we have a absolute incredible amount of stuff to offer here. Mm-hmm. And yes, I want everyone to come here and experience it and enjoy it and love it. But I want them to love it in a tangible way, not just a consumer, like I loved this pizza I had last night kind of way. Like I want them to fully immerse and love it in a way that they care about it and make sure it's here to exist long term, which is really kind of the principle that conservation is built on.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to me that the North American model of wildlife conservation kind of doesn't talk about mentorship in the sense of we do this great job of, and I understand it because no one could have seen the internet coming when that model was invented, right? But they relied on hunting to be what it was and to be as prominent as it was and for it to continue to recruit as it did in order to sustain the funding source, right? The demand, the need. And what they took for granted in that moment, unintentionally, is the need for, and this is my opinion, I'm not trying to speak for you, you can tell me to if you agree or disagree, but they took for granted the fact that there would be an ease of access to the information and the idea of hunting without proper mentorship channels to make sure that those people were onboarded properly. If you go on a mass hiring, you know, spending spree, and you're just hiring people as quickly as possible, and you don't have the middle management to instill culture and to onboard them in a way that is consistent with the company's variables and the expectations of the goals of that position, then you end up with is just a lot of people who aren't really productive and they're not actually contributing, but the bodies are filled. And it feels like with the advent of the internet, we had a lot of people open to the idea of, holy crap, there's ducks at that impoundment right down the street and I can hunt it, right? And the ease of access to go meant that there weren't, in my opinion, sufficient people to grab those people and say, hey, this is the way we're doing this so that they understand the mechanism. And I feel like that's kind of been witnessed during the Duck Dynasty. You know, everybody's like, oh, well, Duck Dynasty ruined duck hunting for a while. I'm not of the opinion that Duck Dynasty ruined hunting. I'm the opinion that Duck Dynasty happened at the exact same time as the advent and dawn of DSL. And so people realized something was out there. And because no one said, hey, come hunting with me and I'll show you what it's all about, they're just kind of left to figure it out.
So I agree. I think there's a shortcoming in the idea of R3. And I think that's pretty common knowledge among most state wildlife agency people and most folks that pay attention to conservation recruitment in the world I live in, most people are aware that there's a problem with R3. There's a deficiency there. Mm-hmm. However, R3 is a really good marketing idea. And let me get myself just in a world of trouble right here off the bat. Youth hunts are pretty ineffective.
Yeah.
Like at the end of the day, I've run a bajillion youth hunts and I've taken advantage of them. I am a dad of two kids. Like I have taken my kids on world-class youth hunts to shoot fully plumed out, you name it. But the simple fact is the people going on those hunts are generally speaking hunters taking their kids that could take their kids any of the other days of the season on a hunt. They're taking advantage of a premier opportunity. That is not a knock on those hunters doing that because again, Travis, me, I have done that before. However, from an R3 standpoint, which is the framework of R3, like the idea, you either recruit, you reactivate, or you retain. Functionally, those are correct ideas. Like you need one of those three things to create a new hunter. We're not doing a good job of it, and we fall into the trap of a youth hunt is the way forward because we're going to instill this in these kids. Aren't you? There were no youth hunts when I was a kid. There were no youth hunts when you were a kid. There was no youth hunts when you know, our grandfathers were kids. And I think that's what you're talking about, mm-hmm. like the mentorship model. We tend to pass that off as mentorship when in reality the mentorship was, I hate to be this guy because I don't think this was good either, but your grandfather handing you a 12 gauge and saying, shoot the acorn out of the top of that tree or the mm-hmm. pine cone out of the top of that tree and it knocks you on the ground and he laughs. Like, you went through this whole experience being in the outdoors with these people where you were along for the ride. You were picking up shells. You were retrieving game. Mm-hmm. You were like this kid out there doing this stuff. I think now people aren't experiencing that. And so they're not being indoctrinated, and that's the right mm-hmm. term, into the stuff that we love well at a beginning level. And I look at it on the fishing side, and like you look at, I had a conversation this morning about forward facing sonar. Mm-hmm. And how that's changed the game in fishing, because now you can actually see the fish and pick the fish that you want to catch and understand where they are in the water column and choose your bait accordingly. That's an advent of technology. And I know that technology is not necessarily a bad thing, but if you look at the idea of fair chase, like you're diminishing the skills required to be an angler, to be a hunter, sometimes using technology. And we talk about removing the barriers to entry. If you look at who's constantly removing those barriers to entry, it's people who are going to benefit financially, mm-hmm. not people that are looking to continue to keep this thing as a viable lifestyle, as a viable fabric of our culture. And to me, this is something I talk about a lot, as a viable conservation tool, like hunting and angling. You talk about development. If a landowner is faced with selling their property, they've got to create revenue streams on that property to keep it from turning into houses. Mm-hmm. Hunting, angling, hiking, camping, those can all be revenue streams. Agritourism, cattle, agriculture, like there's a lot of other things that you could stack and maybe collectively they come close to the value of the property for houses or whatever, and you'd rather it not be houses. Mm-hmm. Your conservation easements, like there's a lot of tools to use in that toolbox, but it's a really complex game to figure out. And it's easier sometimes to say, I don't want to worry with all that. I'm just going to take the check and run. I believe we have to recruit more hunters in Florida. And when I say hunters, I'm not talking just superficially, hey, let's get into hunting. I'm talking like the guys that are after it for the right reasons, because those are the clients that will provide that revenue stream or that impetus to keep that land wild long term. I don't know another game besides that. Like that's,
I'm with you.
People say all the time, like, I don't know if that'll work. And I'm like, yeah, we think that at the beginning of every heist movie we watch, but then, you know, George Clooney and Brad Pitt are, yeah, sipping champagne at the end. So I think it's a game, but I think it's worth playing.
Well, and what you said about R3, I can say this without bias because I mean, no one's going to hold I can't get in trouble with anybody, I guess is what I'm getting at is I feel like if I, as a salesperson, make it a for-profit thing, right? Put it in this context. Hey boss, I found this clientele base, right? We're going to have to spend money to make it interesting. They're not going to spend money with us until 15 years later, 20 years later, when they have disposable income. And we're going to have to wait and hope that in those 15 years, nothing gets in the way that prevents it from being further down the road. They're going to look at me and be like, yeah, you've lost your mind. And for me, R3 falls short in that, like, all the R's are the same size, when in reality, they should be proportional to what we're doing. Because with the Patreon community, we see a lot of like early 30s guys who've got disposable income, who are all saying, hey, I want to get into this thing, but I don't know where to start. Right. And we make fun of, as a community, we oftentimes mock, I'm using royal we, because I don't think you and I necessarily do, but we mock those adult onset hunters as like, you know, well, you didn't come up through the ranks, you don't know what you're doing, and you're kind of weird here. But that's your recruitment. They're not going anywhere, you know, and they're going to indoctrinate that kid the proper way that they have down the path. And a lot of them are coming from like, I don't hunt and fish. My uncle did way back in the day, and that was the catalyst for the change, you know. And it wasn't until they had discretionary income. And so I've never quite understood that emphasis on it being such a focal point. I'm not saying we shouldn't take kids hunting. I just don't know that if we're trying to solve immediate problems and build long term growth, that we have the opportunity to risk waiting 15 years.
Yeah, and or marketing-wise, and I do this, like I run a duck hunting operation. Like it's easy for me to sell hunts if I post a picture of a kid with a duck.
Yeah.
Right? Like that just sells more hunts than me posting a picture of me or you holding a duck.
Yep.
Because me and you, don't move the emotions. I mean, you obviously have model quality looks, which is why you do a podcast, as do I. But the simple fact is you put a kid on there, you put a woman on there, you put a young family on there. Like, there's a way to tell that story. It's no different than any other marketing deal out there.
Yeah.
A youth hunt tugs at heartstrings. Oh, I remember. I mean, we all get tugged at it. I remember my dad taking me squirrel on here, my grandfather taking me fishing or whatever. Like, that's a cause I want to be behind. And I'm not saying not to be behind it. I'm simply saying we sometimes view it as the be all end all or the silver bullet to solve what I believe is a crisis in engagement in hunting and fishing, and or nearing. I think there's an impending crisis. That's what Delta Waterfowl called it a few years ago. And, you know, I bring them up. They do a program where they work with land grant universities to take college students in wildlife sciences on their first hunt.
Brilliant.
Incredible recruitment idea, because like you said, these are all people in an advanced degree program. At some point, you got to imagine they're going to work in wildlife management. At some point, you got to imagine they're going to be young, single with kids, or young married with no kids or whatever. Like, they're going to be they're going to have the disposable income to spend on a bow or to spend on a shotgun and hunt a few times a year on public land or hunt a few times a year. Like, those are the people you want to create, because they're going to, the effectiveness of creating those types of folks is way higher than it is on kind of the spray and pray. Some of us handle recruitment, and I think a lot of brands handle recruitment a way a lot of guys pattern their shotguns, and that's just hope for the best and don't. And you know, if you really want to get into the science of it, like, I'd set up patterning boards and everything else and try different loads. There's a lot of data and science around how we do recruitment, how we do mentorship. So going back to what you said earlier, I don't think that's a problem or a flaw in the North American model. I think it's a shift in two things. One is societal behaviors, which we know less people hunt now because subsistence hunting is not necessarily a thing that's important anymore. And two, and I've gotten some heat for saying this before, but I think the hunting industry, and I'll say the royal we there, the hunting industry, the fishing industry, what they sell is not the experience. What they sell is the kill. What they sell is the harvest. It's not about a lifestyle. It's about an accomplishment. And I think there's a flaw in that logic. Now, I'm not saying they should never post a picture of someone with a monster deer. I'm not saying they should never post a picture of a kid with a giant turkey. I'm not saying they shouldn't do that. I'm just saying the narrative seems to be so one-sided that what we're creating is consumers, not conservationists. And that is a gap that I don't think anyone wants to talk about. We don't want to demonize the friends in our camp. And I'm saying, like, friends are honest with each other. We do a pretty crappy job of that as an industry, as a society. And if you want to know why we're losing and why we're losing, and maybe we're not losing on your bottom line. Maybe you're selling more product year over year. Or maybe your revenue stream is going up because you're raising prices. You're not selling more, but you have a higher margin. I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you we are losing as far as in a state that should seemingly be sportsman friendly in Florida, in the southeastern United States. Our politics are very different than the western states that have hunting and fishing opposition. Hunting is not viewed through the same lens that it is viewed in Alabama or Georgia or so many of those states that, like, we kind of almost take it for granted. And so I say all the time, the thing that will kill conservation in Florida ultimately, but the thing that will kill hunting first is apathy. Like, I kind of take it for granted. There's turkeys walking through my backyard right now. Killing turkeys for me is not a difficult thing to pull off. It's not a hard thing to do. I can take that for granted and not worry about turkey conservation, not worry about understanding the science of it, not worry about advocating for access, and not worry about teaching people to do it the right way, whatever that is, fair chase-wise in my mind. If I start to lean into the apathy, we're going to fail. I see this on the waterfowl side all the time. Like, I'm not an anti-spraying guy. I could talk about spraying all day on lakes and stuff. But the simple fact is, I see guys hunting lakes. I feel like everyone has duck season off now. Like, maybe that's just a misconception I have, but it feels like everyone is off for every day of duck season. Because you see, if you go on a Tuesday and be the only guy on a lake, and now you go on a Tuesday and there's seven other boats out there. So I'm seeing guys conceivably in my mind taking days off to go duck hunting. But then in April, when you have a meeting about a lake management plan, or in October when you have a spray meeting or whatever, oh man, I can't take the time off right now.
Yeah.
And to me, that's apathy. Like, you're going to have to show up, and I show up every day that I can, but simple fact is I'm one dude, one organization.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.
Like, it's going to take a collective group of people to push on this stuff if you want to see positive change, because really, truly, hunting and fishing don't move the needle enough legislatively, popularity-wise, like... We don't have a lobby behind us. We just don't have enough money, we're an economic value to the state. But simple put, if you got rid of all hunting and fishing and you put houses everywhere, that would have a higher economic value than hunting and fishing does. So I think people don't – I don't want to say people are stupid. I think there's a disconnect between 30 years ago, the way you did conservation was you went to a Ducks Unlimited dinner.
Yeah.
And that's not a knock on that. I'm a Ducks Unlimited guy. They're friends, so I'm not picking on them at all. And I recognize there are some people out there that can still do that stuff, and you can throw money over the wall. I've got an organization, All Florida. If you want to throw money at something, we will take it and make sure it goes to good work. But the simple fact is, one of the things we try to encourage is for our members to show up, because if we don't have people showing up, there's no representation for these things. And you know, you could go way down the rabbit hole of funding and how hunters and anglers have funded conservation, going through Pittman Robertson and Dingell Johnson. And simple fact is, in Florida, that's not enough money anymore.
Yeah.
Like, we don't register on the scale high enough to be – we're not nothing, but we're not – I think our state's going to spend – the budget's – we're in session as we're recording this. I think we're going to spend $1.2 billion on conservation as a state this year. That's heavily land conservation. Hunting and angling is worth about $70 million. So somebody could do the math on that. I think we're like 5%
of
the overall conservation budget for the state. So when we go and say, hey, we want to change this thing, tell me another part of the world where you listen to 5% of the population on an issue.
Right.
We need more hunters and anglers so we can increase our footprint and our voice in that. At the same time, our state can't sustain 21 million hunters. We know that as well.
Exactly. That's
not a sustainable model either.
You know, I would go ahead.
No, I was going on a rant. I'm good to go.
I would argue 5% of the population is actually enough to move the needle if moving properly. I think that's where you were going with that, is that 5% has to be a very vocal 5%, right? Because PETA will get things pushed through all the time. Now, I understand they have massive funding behind them too, but that's a minority group of people, very well funded, but a minority, very loud, vocal group of people. And when I look at this, what you said earlier, I didn't know this about, I think you said it was Delta Waterfowl and their mentor. Was that? Yeah. I love that idea every minute that passes, because when I talk to some of the land managers and the biologists who are out here, they don't hunt. They don't fish. Some of them don't even have a positive idea or viewpoint of being an outdoorsman. The idea that those land managers are out there going through, you know, Stephen F. Austin School of Wildlife Management, right? A phenomenal program, right? You would think that someone who went to that wanted, you know, stems from an outdoorsman or outdoorswoman lifestyle. That's not the case. There are some people who just really like the outdoors. And they're going to these programs now, and they're managing deer populations, and they don't give a dang about the deer hunters. That's not part of their focus, because there is a management plan that can be implemented that we're not a part of. And I think that apathy you're talking about can be also flipped to politicians and people in power, because we aren't vocal and all we do is complain via FWC surveys. I mean, let's just call a spade a spade. I know people like you are activists or more active in this, but because we're easy to ignore, why should we have any attention drawn to us?
So, yes, agree 1,000% with everything you just said. The one correction I'd make is I don't think it's that those land managers or those wildlife resource managers don't care about hunters. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're situationally aware. I don't think those people have been given the opportunity to participate in this thing. Mm-hmm. And I see that over and over and over again. In fact, I won't say their names, but I know a couple in Tallahassee that are both very involved in land management with huge organizations, huge, mm-hmm. like non-hunting organizations, like not against hunting, but huge organizations. And both of them have approached me and said, would you take us on a hunt? Because they've never been hunting before. They're mm-hmm. like, we think this might be important that we need to understand it and talk about it and experience it. You'd be shocked how often that conversation happens. And yeah, absolutely, I'll take you on a hunt. Like that becomes priority number one over just about some of our money-making hunters, because the simple fact is that's going to increase access, opportunity, and a mm-hmm. lens through which wildlife management occurs through that could have ripple effects way beyond, you know, the $400 I'd make off of taking them hunting for a day. Mm-hmm. The other thing you said is I think there is a gigantic disconnect, and you could pick the subject, right? We're talking hunting and fishing. You could pick the subject. There's always a disconnect between the people and the governing authorities. Like there's always a disconnect. You could pick the party, you could pick the whatever mm-hmm. it is. But let's say in hunting for just a second, and you could, like I said, you could apply this to any other number of examples. But the fact is, most people in Tallahassee, like most legislators, it's 160-ish legislators up there. Most of them are hunters or have the ability to go hunt somewhere. That doesn't mean they're putting in for quotas. That doesn't mean that they're like, that doesn't mean they understand hunting in Florida. That doesn't, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean they understand what you and I, the average blue collar guy that's trying to get after it on public land, or maybe we can afford a private hunt or two, or we got a friend that lets us go. They don't understand some of what we're going through on the land. And I look even beyond that at, if you look at a project like the Florida Wildlife Corridor, huge conservation success. We're going to create, if your listeners aren't familiar, you're going to create a green infrastructure through the state. It's piggybacked off the work of Carlton Ward. It's piggybacked off the work of Tom Hochter at University of Florida. Mallory Lex Dimmitt and folks at the Wildlife Corridor, great, incredible people. If you look at a project like that, we're going to... Today, there's 10 million acres in the wildlife corridor. About 20% of that, 19% of it, was acquired with sportsman's dollars, meaning hunters and anglers were a significant contributor to this infrastructure. Moving forward, the remaining 8 million-ish acres is primarily going to be acquisitions of easements on private land, which means we're not going to have access to that unless there's a paid access for hunting, in which case oftentimes those owners don't understand that or they're not interested in it because they hunt it with their family or anything else. I believe we have to do a better job of raising our position in our image, our brand, or whatever in the state so that that is taken into account moving forward. So that we consider more opportunities to acquire public land. We consider more opportunities for public-private partnership type access stuff. You know, one of the things we do on duck ranching is I partner with some ranchers and we try to keep the prices lower mm-hmm. to make them more affordable. It's 100% a private entity thing, but we try to make it almost like a public-private partnership where we're allowed more people to get behind a gate. There are farm bill programs out there that allow for private landowners to be offset in cost if they allow public access. Every time I take that to someone in Florida and say, hey, we need to talk about this thing, they say, well, that's crazy. You think you're going to get the state or the government to pay a landowner to allow them to allow someone to privately hunt? And I say, you think that's crazier than us just outright paying a landowner to not develop? Mm-hmm. Like, come on, so don't get to decide what is or is not crazy. Like, we just need some willingness to work together and solve some of these problems. We pass money out like candy at the state level. I just said $1.2 billion in land conservation. I work on this stuff as much as anyone you'll probably talk to. I don't know of any of those dollars beyond the sportsman's dollars, that bottom $35 million. I don't know of any of those dollars that are earmarked for public land acquisition and access for sportsmen, which, by the way, if I was the state and I was talking about customers, you used the example of creating customers a minute ago with your boss. If I was the state and I was talking about customers, we all pay dock stamps. We all pay gas taxes. We all pay like the same set of fees. It's commensurate to you maybe pay more in gas if you're on the road more. I pay less because I'm at home, whatever. My house is bigger. I pay more there. But generally speaking, level set, a citizen pays a flat amount of taxes for living here. But then hunters and anglers pay another tax, and I don't love calling it a tax, but that's what the legislators would call it, so we're going to play their game. We pay a tax above and beyond it. Wouldn't you, if you lived in business world, that's one of the few places you could increase revenue is by creating more of those customers.
That's right.
I can't imagine a scenario where you sell watches or widgets or anything else, and you say, we don't really want more of the people that buy our highest-end watches and widgets. We want less of them because we want to kowtow to these people. That doesn't hold water. Like, it doesn't pass the reasonableness test. So I think we have not done a good job of presenting that argument and recruiting lawmakers to be on our side in this conversation. Not that they're against us. I think they're kind of naive to, I'll say, the plight of the sportsman in the state. Mm-hmm. And so they look at the lens through the stuff that they know, the stuff they hear about. Oftentimes that's going to be your lobbyists and that's going to be your big money guys and everything else. And, you know, I go to Tallahassee frequently and I'm going to be honest with you guys. It's expensive to be there. It's expensive to literally stay in a hotel in that city.
Yep.
And eat out. And like, there's a lot of stuff that happens in rooms and in meetings behind the scenes for it being the Sunshine State with sunshine laws. We get our, you know, what's whooped pretty regularly by people with way bigger checkbooks and way more ability to play that game than we will ever have. So we've got to play it smarter. We've got to play it well. I think there's a lot of days there's not the vast majority of us aren't playing it at all. I'm not saying you need to go lobby.
Yeah.
But I am saying there are some groups out there that are doing work in that space that are, you know, and All Florida's one of them. Isaac Walton League, Mike Elfenbein's one of them. Like, we're busting our tail trying to get some stuff done here. And you turn around and look, and it's like, where's everybody that's behind us on this stuff? Oh, they're busy doing something else.
You know, I think there's a large degree of responsibility that folks like myself bear, you know, the Southern Collective bear, because you've touched on a lot of things that we have a lot of influence on. And I volunteered my criticism of the lack of mentorship, right? And I think it's one of those things where to get downloads and to get views, you have to have something exciting. What's the easiest thing that's exciting? Well, it's a kill, right? And if you build your model based on that immediate success and you don't build your model based on standing for something a little broader that takes a little more work, and I'm not judging anybody who does this, I am easily acknowledging that it would be easier for me to kill $5 on an outfitted hunt and sell that, right? Where the storytelling takes a backside, right? And it takes effort and you have to find a good artist. I mean, it's all art. You know, I'm giving Parker a tremendous amount of credit here. It is an art form to tell a story. That's why not everybody has a book, right? Because the story is hard to tell. But I think we're charged with that responsibility to mentor inadvertently through the influence of what we put out there. If I put out a good video with a kill in it that tells a good story, that is just as good. It probably, honestly, it's better than the video that might be 10 minutes long that has 180 inch Ohio whitetail, right? Because if you give me the choice between this guy kills 180 inch whitetail in 10 minutes, or this guy's got a 22 minute video and he shows the struggle and he shows the summer prep and it's at a high frame rate with a good, like with good quality gear. Again, there's a cost barrier there. I'm going to watch that 22 minute video all day of the week. Cause I want to feel like I'm part of something. And so, you know, I think that extends to our, I'll pull myself out here directly, my lack of involvement in these things. Right? I've got a platform. I perhaps bear more responsibility to be leading as an example of being in those Tallahassee meetings because it's relatively cheap for me to drive to the Capitol and be there. It's hard though, because the entire, I'm going to call it an industry / community, says that that free time should be spent shed hunting instead. You know, I should be out there looking for sheds. I should be looking for last year's rubs. It's harder to tell a conservation story and it be sexy too. Right. But it's kind of a necessity to what you're talking about. And it's always floored me. And maybe you've got an idea on this because you're in this realm a little more. It's always floored me that sportsmen don't have a Sierra Club, like air quotes, or just an organization where everybody's throwing as much money as possible to buy land and to collaborate with some of these state agencies. Do you know why that doesn't exist? Is that just not something that has ever gained any traction? I mean, that just floors me.
Because sportsmen can't get along with each other.
That's a good point. That's valid.
That's the simple answer. And I'm not saying all Florida is that, but I am saying like we created all Florida because we, mm-hmm. were the only sportsman's group being included in conservation. So conservation in the state of Florida doesn't straight up consider hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have I would say the largest conservation groups in Florida don't use the word hunting,
mm-hmm.
or fishing. Like by and large, they're not interested in that because there's less customers there. And the imagery that accompanies those practices leads to someone being offended,
mm-hmm.
which means they're going to lose money in their revenue stream of donors. Part of the reason we created All Florida was to be what we call an authentic conservation organization, which means we advocate for land, we advocate for water, we advocate for wildlife and endangered species. You saw our snail kite video we just put out. Like,
yep.
We're really, truly trying to advocate for all the aspects, but the thing that I think gets lost in this is the way of life. Like, I've been saying this a lot recently. You could pick up Disney World and stick it in Nebraska. And generally speaking, they're not going to lose much revenue. They might because of a snow day or two, but it's going to be exactly the same. You could go pick up the Villages and you could set it in Anniston, Alabama. And the revenue is basically going to be the same. Like, everything's going to look the same, feel the same, be the same. What makes Florida special is its geology, its geography, its ecology, and its people. And when I say its people, those people have a connection to these things that, like, I mean, I can get emotional talking about it. The stuff that matters, if you read A Land Remembered, it's the stuff that's discussed in a book like that, like your ranching, your agriculture, your hunting, your fishing, your camping out, like in the wilds of, like, it's an experiential place to be. And I struggle a lot because I don't think in the sportsman's world, a lot of the videos and stuff we post, generally speaking, I'm not criticizing you. I'm saying this is the royal we.
Yeah.
A lot of the videos and stuff we post, the location doesn't really matter that much. We mm-hmm. talk about the location because we're collecting in different states or we're trying to create our slam or whatever. Simple fact is that video is the same as if I'm a storyteller, and I am, like I work on story a lot. The concept or the components of that story are they exist regardless of kind of the setting and the way the setting is as a character in the story. I think we could do a better job with that. And I think it's a miss because we don't have, I said this on another podcast interview recently. I don't remember where. One of my favorite statistics about Florida is that we lead the nation in coffins exported. And what that means is people move here, they die here, and then they want to be buried where they're from. And what I really want, like my whole mission, my whole goal is for people to fall in love with this place to where they want to be here. This is their place, not somewhere else. Until we can, and that's a quixotic goal, right? Like I'm tilting at windmills a little bit there. The simple fact is until we make that part of our mission, mm-hmm. it's not going to change, and it's not going to change in a measurable way, which is why I'm so passionate about Right to Fish and Hunt. Like that's a constitutional ballot initiative that we got on the ballot for this November where people will be able to ensconce that right. It's easy for your audience, the hunters and anglers, to say, oh, that's easy. We'll vote for that. We support it. It's way harder for the average Floridian transient to vote for that until we can connect them to the idea of hunting is conservation, fishing is conservation, and not because I'm managing deer population, because frankly, there's other ways I could manage deer population yep. in Florida. It's because it is imperative to saving land. It's imperative to clean water. It's mm-hmm. imperative to these things that do matter to you as a citizen of the state. Man, I think that is where we, and I say that's what we try to do with All Florida, but that's also a gap that I think hunting and fishing organizations often have, is connecting that story, connecting those people to a place in a way that matters to them. You know, people care about stuff that's going to allow them to survive and allow them to thrive. And I try to tell people all the time, like an organization like ours, if you're a sportsman, if you are a lover of Wild Florida, it's going to allow you to survive and thrive. Those are the two things that should matter the most to you. And we're going to do that through a number of avenues. The other thing I wanted to mention when you talked about going to a meeting in Tallahassee is I don't marginalize either the fear of public speaking. If you asked any group of 100 people
yeah.
what their biggest fear is, public speaking is like 90 of them. Like, it's a big deal. And I've gone to a billion meetings and spoke. There are still days when on the right topic, my heart feels like it's going to come out of my chest when I walk up there. And people are like, man, you're so good at this. It's fake. Like, I'm making it up. Like, it's no different than standing in front of class mm-hmm. and you had a crush on the cute girl and you didn't want to embarrass yourself talking in front of her in Spanish or what. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just public speaking is hard to do. It's difficult to do. But, you know, I'm out there. You can message us at allfla.org is our website, but you can message us on social, allfla.org. If you want help with that kind of stuff, we'll help you write remarks. We'll help you, like, get in front of a microphone. But I tell people all the time, just go to a meeting. Just go to a meeting and show up and like sit in the room and be present so you start to understand this process. And you're going to hear things you dislike. You're going to hear things you agree with. You're going to start to formulate. I can sit right now and I'm involved in probably 15 counties around the state. I can tell you of those 15 counties, these are the three commissioners I like, these are the four I don't like, or whatever. You may have very different experiences there. And guess what? Because you like one I dislike, you may be able to get some headroom in mm-hmm. a conversation with that person that I can't get because I've got a bias against them because I've formed an opinion over another interaction. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about showing up and speaking at a podium. It's about showing up, understanding the process, and beginning to use whatever influence you have, because it's amazing in the worlds we live in. I guarantee you there are people listening to this that know state representatives, they know county commissioners, they know city commissioners, they know mayor, like they know people of influence, or their mom works for them, or their cousin used to date them, or like they have a connection somewhere to them. We need to be leveraging that to create more influence for us in the decision-making rooms, in the rooms that matter, as Hamilton said. And then we need to be leveraging that to tell better stories to those people in succinct ways so that they can connect with the stuff that matters to us. Because what I see right now is the state cares deeply about conservation. The state of Florida leads the country in land conservation. Like, there's no debating that. Mm-hmm. I can give you 37 different statistics that we lead the country in thinking about that. We do not lead the country in quota hunts for turkeys. Like, and I'm not saying those two things are on equal importance, although yeah. I would guess a lot of your listeners, they would be inverse importance,
yep.
but they are equally important because most turkeys are produced on private land, even public land turkeys. Most of them, like 92% mm-hmm. of them or something, Chamberlain and Collier, those guys will tell you they're all produced on private land. So we've got to do a better job of managing that resource if we want to manage this resource. It's all interconnected somehow. Yep. And figuring out what those angles are and figuring out ways we can connect that story to legislators and understand, hey, I know that you are a well-off lawyer from Orlando or Jacksonville, and you can get in a plane and fly to Tennessee and shoot two turkeys this afternoon if you want to, or shoot a mule deer in Montana if you want to. But your constituents, most of us can't do that. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the future of your constituency will look very different if we can't connect some people to be able to do that.
Yeah. What makes That's you relevant? Example. What makes you relevant and relatable can be lost if your constituency is lost.
It's a political strategy.
Yeah.
Ultimately, if I was a politician, that would be something I think about a lot is like, you know, in Florida, you can serve, I think, 8 years in the 8 years in the House and 8 years in the Senate. So you could serve 16 years in the state legislature in Florida. And then oftentimes you want to promote to like D.C. or wherever. And I even see some that are career politicians. They come back and then run for county commission or something because they make more money doing that. The simple fact is if those people are going to be in some level of influence for 16 to 30 years, wouldn't you think they would want to create a constituency that wants to have their back because they've had our back on the things that we care about? That's not – you're never going to stop development in Florida.
No.
You can't. And it's almost silly to rail against it some days. That's not to say we could do a better job regulating it, but like – you look at the villages, and I know some people involved in the villages that are good sportsmen, anglers, like they care about wild Florida. If we took those people out of the equation, nature abhors a vacuum. Someone else is going to step in there and do a much worse job with it than they are.
Yeah.
You could do the same thing at a Mosaic. You could do the same thing pick any of the big centers that we like to label as the boogeyman in the state. Mm-hmm. You could very, very easily. If we took Mosaic off the landscape, there's still phosphate in the ground and some other company is going to come in here and try to figure out how to exploit that. And they're going to have a lot of money because there's a lot of money in it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not absolving them of a spill or absolving them of anything they've done wrong. At the same time, like figuring out a way to work with them feels like a better strategy than demonizing them over and over and or shape regulation around them. But we're not going to even affect much shaping of regulation around development. Phosphate, runoff, et cetera, until we can increase the conservation footprint in legislative offices. And we're in no risk of doing that anytime soon.
It's interesting to me because we're coming through the villages, we're coming through Central Florida, and I'm going to admit something that might get me in trouble. But that part of Florida was so depressing to me. In the panhandle's gorgeous. The panhandle's gorgeous. You go any direction and even the finest subdivisions have these huge trees and the water is not diverted in such a way that it's an inconvenience, but it's a feature of the area and it's just gorgeous. And then you disappear and you're in a national forest for 500,000 acres. I'm spoiled. I come from extreme privilege residing here and I recognize that. And I go through Florida, and we're taking some of these back roads to avoid a toll road that had a really bad accident on it. And it's gorgeous and it's pasture land. I'm like, oh my God, that'll get you. There's turkeys everywhere out here. Like, this just is awesome. And then we round the corner and it's like the wall that you just envision of modernization. And just like, if you can, like, in your mind, see just tractors and bulldozers and everything just coming over the horizon, and all of a sudden behind it is what they've built, right? And it was so debilitating. I told Elaine, I was like, oh man, like, I don't know if I could like stay in Florida if this kind of expansion continues, you know, because it's just gone. And you talk about telling that story, and I've read those books. I need to read them again. It feels like we've kind of given up. It's not the right word I'm looking for, but we've just kind of given up on the idea of selling the Florida culture. Like, what makes Florida, Florida? Because that was what a lot of it's what attracted a lot of this initial investment, right? And then we've kind of got lost in the process, it feels like, as a state, and I'm royal we here. And we got to find some balance to that. But I think you're hitting the nail on the head. We have to tell a better story. We have to connect the why behind a lot of this, because it's exceedingly rare what we have here. I mean, it's just unreal.
It's fascinating because it feels sometimes almost dystopian. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean in like a Hunger Games type dystopian. I mean in like a, man, I grew up, I'm of the age where like Speed was a big movie when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Remember the movie Speed mm-hmm. with Keanu Reeves?
Yeah.
And they're running around Los Angeles and like the traffic is all gridlocked everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like driving anywhere now is, so I live in Polk County, which last year was the fastest growing county in the state. I would imagine we'll be close to it, but if you watch the fastest growing counties in the state, they change a lot because we develop out so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're in a land race. Like that's at the end of the day. And I don't want to sound like anything I've said is marginalizing land conservation. I think land conservation is incredibly important.
Sure.
The corridor's incredibly important. I just think we have got to increase our footprint. You know, we're talking largely as sportsmen here. I tend to talk general conservation a lot more when I'm in a sportsman's room. When I go in an environmentalist room, I tend to talk more sportsmen because I'm trying to get them to come our way. But it's almost dystopian in its feel sometimes. Like you turn and you're driving through gorgeous what it's probably now planted slash pines or something, but at one point was longleaf mm-hmm. and now it's got palmetto flatwoods under it, and you turn the corner and it's like what should look exactly like that is nothing but sand for as far as the mile can see, as the eye can see, because we're turning into houses. And it's stark, man. It's like you just went from indoor to Tatooine or something. Like it's a stark contrast in landscape. And it breaks my heart because that could exist anywhere. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to exist here. And we're not connecting enough. There's like this war of attrition. If 1,000 people move, the real number is 800. If 800 people move here a day, 300,000 a year, roughly, and we can convince 10% of them to care about wild Florida, that's mm-hmm. 30,000 this year. It feels like a lot, but the simple fact is we have to do it again next year. And we have to start all over because those 300,000 people that move here are going to not understand. And what we're also seeing is folks that are in love with the way of life of Florida are beginning to defect.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen this. I can think of probably 22 or 24 young family types that have left the state that are hunters, anglers, conservation-minded people. They can't take it anymore.
Yeah,
they can't afford a house. They can't afford, like, so you see them moving to a Tennessee. You see them moving to a Mississippi. You see them moving to a North Alabama. And it's because they've got to break up with this almost toxic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to replace those people with people that are not connected to it in any way, shape, or form. And,
yeah.
You know, I make no bones about it. My wife would be like, let's go tomorrow. She jokingly says all the time, she's like, we should just move to Montana and you can work on conservation in the big leagues. And I'm like, babe, this is the big leagues. Like, no disrespect to anyone out there, but you live in a state that has less people than my county. And everyone in the state has a hunting license or is married to someone with a hunting license or is the son mm-hmm. or father of someone with a hunting license. Like, that ain't the big leagues when it comes to conservation. It's really easy.
Yeah.
To lob stuff in from the gallery. This is the pros down here. And if you, no different than the hunting conversation we had a minute ago, like if you can work in conservation here, you could probably work in conservation anywhere because this is really, really hard. It's a tough nut to crack, man. And I don't know the answer. The best effort I have right now is to continue to show up every day
mm-hmm.
and to continue to advocate for those things that are the most things. That's the woods, water, wildlife, way of life. Like I say the most because those are the things that are going to keep intact what makes this place special. And we're not going to win them all. And people call me all the time and they're like, hey, we want to stop this development from going in. And I'm like, God, that's going to suck from the traffic standpoint. And I don't understand. Like, I don't think anyone that's ever made a law or approved a development has ever driven on a road here.
Mm-hmm.
Ever.
Mm-hmm.
Like they mm-hmm. must all have like a private network of tunnels to how they move around because their roads are grotesque. Like
they're horrible. No, yeah.
I used to commute to Orlando when I worked in corporate America mm-hmm. and from my house to my office in Orlando was like 50 minutes. Now it's 2.5 hours.
That's insane.
My wife has to go in periodically to a office nearby there from the same house. 2.5 hours regularly for her to get there. And that's not a lifestyle people want to live. That's not a quality of life people want to experience. Like, that's so anyway, where I was going with that is infill development. A lot of times people bring it to me and I just wave at it. Yeah, I hate that that was a cow pasture and now it's going to be turned into tract homes, but it was surrounded on four sides by development. It's going to end up as a development. Like, I'd rather that go than the corridor or this much larger parcel over here or something else. Like, that's why you'll see me get a little more fired up over urban sprawl.
Yeah.
When you see Polk County recently, they approved a development. It was 10 miles from the nearest grocery store and it was going to be 8,000 homes. And thankfully we were able to work together with a bunch of organizations to get that land into conservation. But this development was going to become another city in the state just out in the middle of pristine wilderness in the wildlife corridor. And it's like, man, we can't keep doing that stuff. And I can't believe that we're okay with it. And I don't want to get political about it, but like a lot of these are people I voted for that are supporting this kind of policy and growth. And we just kind of disconnect from it because we get caught up in other sexier topics when in reality, that's the one that's going to affect us the most on a daily basis. It's not most of the other things that we see in the headlines. It's unmanaged growth without putting some parameters in that and no one likes to do that because it's governing capitalism, but without putting some parameters in place on that stuff, I shudder to think of what my home's going to look like in 10 years, your home's going to look like in 10 years. I mean, the panhandle is coming for you, man.
I know.
It is marching fast in that direction. And we staved off the toll roads. We staved off the toll roads pretty aggressively, you know, that expansion, the road to nowhere. It was going to go to the Georgia boundary and Georgia DOT was like, we don't have any plans ever to put anything there. But when those types of roads go in, you know that what's going to follow them is development, growth, et cetera. And if you go look at the landowners for the parcels that it was going to cut through, they're all huge landowners that are looking to develop and grow their portfolio. The rich want to get richer. That's part of their game. I get that.
Nothing wrong with that.
But if anybody's listening to this and they're rich and they want to donate to people that are working against it, we will gladly take your money and we promise we will do good stuff with it because someone has to show up and speak up against this stuff.
Yeah.
That's the other kind of side of the game no one likes to talk about. And this wasn't the intention of where we were going. But a lot of times what you'll see too is, and I've done it before, like we wanted to get Right to Fish and Hunt on the ballot. In order to do that, I wasn't going to talk about growth laws. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't want to pick a fight with a legislator that might be sponsoring the bill that I was trying to get done. We often see that happen where you kind of end up getting muzzled and unable to say the thing. But our commitment has always kind of been, we're going to tell the truth when we're asked and when we're given the opportunity to speak. We can't fight every fight, but we're going to try to show up for the biggest fights as often as we can. Anyway.
I mean,
sorry, I went off on a tangent there a little
bit. But the development is coming up here. I mean, they just put in a 1,300 acre, or they're in the process of putting in a 1,300 home subdivision on the north side of town, all surrounding Lake Jackson, a lake that at present can't keep full because of a aquifer problem. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's like, you know, and even I live kind of out in the sticks, to be honest with you. And land's getting so expensive inside the city that they're coming out here and taking 3-4 acre tracts with dilapidated mobile homes on it, buying it, bulldozing the entire thing, turning it into quarter acre lots and then selling it. And it's like, dude, that's coming. Like that is the reality of the situation, especially with the cost of homes right now. So, you know, I it's kind of a good thing and a bad thing. And I'll speculate and we can either take this topic or leave it alone. I wonder if a water problem isn't going to kind of create a tipping point in this where we're going to have a little more negotiating power, because it feels like unchecked growth on an aquifer could be a bad thing. Just an account it. I'm not going to say I've got the science
figured out. I don't think that's going to – we're already out of water in South Florida.
Right.
Like DEP put a map out in – or no, Thousand Friends of Florida put a map out in like 2018 showing water quality or water supply. And like Polk, Hillsborough, Pasco, and then there was a little reprieve, and then South Florida, all are red. They don't have enough water supply for the population today. Like, there's not enough water in those counties for the population today, which means we're sucking the aquifer that is all connected to where you're at.
Right.
What we're going to do to solve that is we're going to go toilet to tap. Mm-hmm. We're gonna start doing reclaimed water, and we'll start seeing desalination. Yep. I think it's desalination plants put in to turn salt water into fresh water. Those are things that we're going to see very soon because we don't have a choice. And I struggle with that. Like, I don't want to get you in trouble in any way, shape, or form. But I have no problem telling people I'm a Republican. I've been a Republican my life. I tend to vote Republican. That's how I lean. I'm a conservative from the deep South. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, I'm frustrated with the Republican Party because I think sometimes we don't regulate the stuff we should regulate, and we do regulate the stuff we shouldn't. And in this case, I'm like, man, stop fighting over stuff that I don't care about and start fighting for some stuff I do care about. But at the end of the day, lobbying dollars are what's going to drive all that. Yeah. And we don't have a lobbyist for water. Can you imagine if all of the environmental conservation and sportsman's groups got together and paid 10 grand to hire a lobbying firm for $1 million to push back on development and I'm not seeing development to end it, because a lot of people listening to this probably make jobs in construction and everything.
Yeah.
Else. I'm not trying to jeopardize your income or your anything else. I am trying to save your quality of life for living here and mm-hmm. our long-term quality of life for living here. There's no reason, if Nestle wants to take water out of the aquifer to bottle water, I'm okay with it as a free market capitalist. I just think they should have to pay for it. Not $500. I think they should have to pay 39 cents a bottle or something. I don't know what the number is, but like, my water bill is higher than Nestle's for bottling water from the state to sell. And I don't understand how that's possible.
I know.
Anyway, I just think there's a lot of unchecked stuff happening. And until, let's roll it back to sportsmen for a second. But until we as sportsmen, and forgive me, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but until we get our shit together, mm-hmm. until we can figure out that, hey, you know what? I may not like everything that Travis says, but his heart's in the right place and he's going to keep showing up and trying to get this right. Or I don't like everything that CCA does, but CCA shows up every day and fights for these things. Like, there's some organizations out there doing this type of stuff. Until we recognize that, hey, we're going to have to align behind some of them that care mm-hmm. about this place, we're not going to see that change. And we may feel good when we leave XYZ banquet because we won a gun in the raffle or whatever, and we contributed $1,000 to conservation. The simple fact is, it's not going to move the needle for what's happening in our state. And I don't mean that reductively to those organizations, because I didn't name an organization there, but like, you could list any organization and I could defend them in Florida for the work that they've done, because they all have the best of intentions. And I'm mm-hmm. talking specifically sportsmen's organizations now. But the fact is, until we can figure out a way to amalgamate some of that funding and that effort into state specific type stuff, we're just going to keep losing. My hope is to keep playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you look at, I'm a game theory guy. If you look at like a baseball
infinite
game,
versus finite games,
nine innings, I love it. Or whatever.
Yep.
Yeah, a baseball game's nine innings, and it's defined by outs and runs and whoever. Like, there's a set of rules around it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, that's a finite game. So you know when the beginning is, you know when the end is. An infinite game is a game where the idea is to continue to play the game. I think we as sportsmen have to figure out how to play the infinite game when it comes to conservation. I think we as conservationists need to figure out how to play the infinite game when it comes to the state of Florida. And I don't think we are very strategic about that. Again, one guy, one organization's opinion. I don't think we're very strategic about it. I think we could do way better than we have done, and I think we could do way better moving forward. And I don't mean that as a slight as we're at to where we are, because you're always learning new information. What I just said in 3 years will be irrelevant because we will have new information that changes what I just said.
Right. You know, it's one of those things where I think if you're the party really doesn't matter. It, on a local level, the state of Florida, it really doesn't matter if your means of identifying as to whether or not you're a supporter of conservation comes by a choice of two colors, let's just say three colors, you've already lost the discussion of whether or not you're impacting any change. And that's why, you know, like, you volunteered your Republican. I come from very blue roots. My family's from Ohio. We come from very blue roots. I'm kind of a purple person in a lot of ways. I am all for a free market. Absolutely all for a free market. I do not at all support preservation efforts for wildlife. That's a personal choice. I'm not saying you guys can't, but I think preservation is a short-sighted blue topic, right? It's like we have to landlock these things, never change them, never allow any timbering because big trees are good trees. No, that's not necessarily true, right? And so I say that to say, I feel like if you're identifying one way or the other, you've lost because there's nuance across the board. There are going to be Republicans who support conservation. And there's going to be Republicans who don't. The same thing on the left. And I think one of the issues we have is that same apathy. It's what you're talking about. It's that same vein. You know, we spend all of this time. I'm going to reclaim my soapbox from you, Travis, for just a second. But we spend all this time bickering over cell cameras and crossbows and TSS and camouflage and e-bikes and all of this crap, this garbage that under ideal circumstances, I'd have more time to focus on. I would allocate time and resources. But when you look at these issues that we face, like development and the loss of these really fragile ecosystems, because I'm with you, if it's a cow pasture versus like, I don't know, a cypress swamp, right? I'm going to choose the cypress swamp, right? And it has a different value to it. And I can acknowledge that. Those are the conversations I feel like we should be having right now. We should be having these conversations of, okay, yes, I can take 10 days of PTO to go to Ohio, right? I can leave the state, because that's a lot of times what we do as deer hunters too, right? Instead of spending any time trying to make this better, we blame dog hunters. We complain about quota hunts. And then we go to the state of Ohio and we shoot our deer. We come back and we rinse and repeat and take advantage of terrific turkey hunting and then go right back to Ohio and Kentucky, right? And I'm not saying you have to hunt in this state. But until as a community we look at this and go, we play a role in this. We're responsible for this. We're going to have to do some of the unfun things. Like my dad taught me that, right? I always have a Walmart bag on me. And I'm always picking up trash, right? You know, people give BHA hell all the time for like all of these like, you know, IPA events that they do and all this stuff. I'm going to tell you something. I don't see any other group of people right now going out there and cleaning up the national forest where people are dumping, you know, box springs and toilets and all kinds of stuff. They're the only people out there cleaning it up. So maybe you don't agree with BHA on some stuff. Fine. So be it. But at the same time, they're out there cleaning up the place you're going to go turkey on later on. And let's find that connective tissue that we all have and run with it. And I'm always, you speculated there. You said I if all of these organizations would hire a lobbying firm, I sometimes there's like the conspiracy theory part of me that wonders if that isn't intentional in the sense of like, they just don't care or they're waiting for things to get bad enough to where they can change the industry into like, hey, let's see what we're doing. I don't necessarily believe that that's true, but it kind of feels that way sometimes because you have these market like dominators. You have companies like 3M that own Sitka, right? And if Sitka and some of these big brands, I'm not trying to like target them because they do a lot for conservation and I feel self-conscious sure. that I put point in the finger. But let's just say if these big companies, whatever they are, donated a fraction of what they have towards lobbying, it would have an immediate impact. I mean, it'd be huge. It's why I support the Sportsmen's Alliance, because they're out there fighting the legislative changes that are coming down the pipe and the lawsuits. And so I don't know, man. I think it comes down to people like you who are doing the hard work and having the unfortunate conversations that it probably feels exhausting to have for you. You might also feed off of it. I don't know, but I'm sure, you know, at the local check-in station, these conversations aren't necessarily the easiest to have. And yet probably essential to have.
I look at, okay, I'll be candid with you because I don't really care at the end of the day. Like if your listeners like me, great. If they don't, that's okay too. Like I don't like everybody in the world either. I'm not a big Captains for Clean Water guy. As a guy that works in the state of Florida, I'm not a big fan of Captains for Clean Water because of policy differences. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like I disagree with like some of their positions. It's not a slight of them as human beings or anything.
Right.
But that said, if you look at like Yeti's partnership with Captains for Clean Water, mm-hmm. I'd imagine that Yeti is cutting them a pretty good check and or just giving them enough brand visibility to where it's raising their profile to where they have more political influence to get stuff done. Now, I'll tell you candidly, because I'm already in trouble, I don't ever see those guys in meetings. Like, I've never seen them at an FWC commission meeting. They don't show up as much as I think they should show up to places. But the fact is, they raise a lot of money, and they use that money. I'm assuming they spend it on staffing or lobbying or whatever they spend it on. I'm not saying this to make a conversation about captains. I'm saying this to use it as an example of you could see more brands in the industry saying, hey, we want to align with organization X, Y, or Z. And even I think, because this is what happens a little bit, is you'll see that get watered down because they want to align with a national brand because it's got more mass appeal. Mm-hmm. But then you get into a situation like Florida, like we're talking big money conflicts and conversations here. And it makes me sick to talk about money that much. But the simple fact is, like, you're talking about a lobbyist in the state of Florida for a year of any ilk. You're talking $100,000, $150,000. Like, if you want to get something done. Mm-hmm. And really, you're going to need to pay them that for several years because they're going to have to go couch it with leadership in the Senate or the House or whatever it is. And if we hired a lobbyist tomorrow, we wouldn't know what to do with him because who's going to decide what to do with him? Like, it's really, we've backed ourselves into this. We've painted ourselves into a corner. Mm-hmm. And until we recognize, hey, we're going to have to set aside some differences and get together on some stuff. And again, I'll present All Florida as one of the alternatives for that conversation. But I'll give you one on the fishery side because I work with these guys all the time. CCA is a polarizing organization. I know people that are like, CCA is the worst thing ever because they did not support 2 redfish a day in XYZ region. Or they were okay with the closure of snook in this region or whatever. And that thing has set them off to be against CCA. But when you step back and you look at the big picture of the quality of work that CCA has done, both over their history, they are single-handedly the organization responsible for the net ban, but also they've done more oyster, like they've done the biggest oyster restoration effort in the southeastern United States, maybe in the world. Like, it's gigantic in Turtle Bay. You look at what they're doing with clams. You look at what they're doing with redfish restocking. And some people are like, oh, I don't like that. I don't like that. I don't like that. The simple fact is those guys are showing up day after day and doing stuff that is through their best effort improving the quality of life for us in the state. I don't agree with CCA on everything, but I'm a lifetime member of them because right. I believe that's the kind of folks I want to be aligned with, is folks that show up day after day. I don't ever go in a room that I don't see. If it is fisheries or water related, I see somebody from CCA in that room, and usually a staff person that's got a connection in that room. And so I'm like, yeah, you don't have to love them. You know, I'm not asking you to date them. I'm simply saying, like, if you're going to support some people in the fights, like, those are the types of groups that need your funding. They need your effort. They need your membership. They need to be able to count you on the roll. And if you want to put an effort in, they're the type of organizations that can take that effort and move it forward. I'll give you one on the hunting side that I think is interesting too, that's kind of been undersold, is, and I don't know how many of your, I don't know your demographics on listenership, but if your wives, your girlfriends, your daughters aren't members of American Daughters of Conservation, like, I don't know how familiar you are with ADC.
Never heard of them before.
It's AD Conserve, I think, is their Instagram and social media handles and stuff. That's a group that they get women into the outdoors in a safe, fun, and exciting way, but they are also the ones building wood duck nest boxes. They're also the ones walking around in Ocala picking up trash. They're also the ones, like, scheduling small game hunts. They're an incredible organization that shows up way more often than not. And so I think until we figure out ways that we can start to promote and share some of these stories of these groups that are doing good work in Florida and ways to fund the work that they're doing, I think we're going to continue to tread water. And my goal, like I said earlier, is to continue to try to play the game as long as we can play the game. Like, some point we'll have to pass that baton off to somebody else. But, like, it's just keeping showing up over and over and over again. And it's not glamorous. It's not sexy. I do love the riddle of trying to save this state. Like, I love the puzzle of trying to save the state. Like, that's something that gets me out of bed in the morning, is like, you know, there's not much I love more than Florida. My wife and my kids and my dogs. Those are the three things I'd probably put ahead of my adoration for And I love it all, man. From the cows to the cypress marsh to the I used to guide inshore, like the mangrove marshes and the tarpon jumping and whitetails and teal, and like, man, it's just, there's no place like this on the planet. It is so incredibly special. And we just, I think people get how special it is, but sometimes we have a short-term memory, and we've got to really, maybe we get it in the moment, and it's a lust for how special it is, but we've got to get them to fall in love with this state in a way that they care about it so deeply that it's like seared into your consciousness and your unconsciousness so that you can't stop thinking about it. You can't let it go. It's a thing that you deeply care about.
I think there's a place for us. You know, you talked about the exposure to those people. I think it goes back to a mentorship in a slightly different way of, and I'm speculating here because I'm sure a lot of people do this, but I've gone on several charter fishing trips, right? I can't afford to go after Red Snapper. Think it's awesome, but I can't afford that boat or the gas bill. Hell, I can't afford the tires to go on the trailer to pull one, right? Never have I ever had any of those people tell me about the conservation organization that supports that thing that I enjoy so much. Right. Like if I was in that realm, I would, and I'm not trying to call anybody out here or cast, you know, doubts on motives, but like if I was in that realm, my thought would be, I need to have them funding CCA. Right. You know, that's the only one that pops to mind for me. I'm sure there's 1,000 others that are really great options, but it's one of those things. Like it feels like if I took people turkey hunting, I'd be like, hey, I know you enjoyed this. This is a really rare thing. I hope you appreciate it. And if you do, here's a card to the local NWTF, you fill in the blank. Like if we started making that part of that normalized conversation, I feel like it would go a long way because we just do those things. Like the people like you're a bad example because you're actively telling people, but there's a lot of people I know that are active in this that they don't talk about it. They don't just bring it up in casual conversation as if it's part of the process that everyone should just be expected to do. Like it was picking up trash. Like when I went with my dad, the expectation was if I am not in pursuit of a squirrel in that moment, right? That was the one exception he gave me. If I'm not pursuing a squirrel in that moment, or a rabbit or whatever it was, and I walked past trash, he was going to be disappointed in me. That was just the expectation. And I feel like we kind of have to have a little bit of that with where we're going. Is the expectation is you're going to fund people like All Florida. You're going to fund people like CCA. And when they say, hey, we need you at a meeting, you're going to save a little bit of that PTO, a couple of those chits with your wife. You know, you might take your kid with you. You know, it might come at a bit of a cost, but it has to become part of that process. Oh, no, I'm plugging my laptop. Glad it lasted this long. So I think if you're listening to this and you have that influence, like having those cards or having that dialogue and stickers.
You know, it's funny. We used to talk all the time about when I was guiding inshore and when I was guiding on my boat for ducks, no one ever asked to see a captain's credential. Mm-hmm. No one ever asked to see insurance documents. And no one ever asked if we did any work with conservation groups. Those are the big three jokes. And like, I talk about that stuff a lot. Like every year before duck season, I'd put a post out with like a picture of my guide's license, my captain's license, mm-hmm. with like my address and pertinent information redacted. But like, hey, if you're going to book a duck hunt, why not ask if your guide has this thing? Because if he doesn't, like you might be getting into an illegal, but I'm not saying you are, but like,
could be.
It's a reasonable conversation to have to do your due diligence. The simple fact is most of us, we talked about this earlier, most of us are consumers. Mm-hmm. We want the best deal, the best price that gets us the results that we want. So if I can pay a guy under the table $150 to take me to catch Red Snapper, why would I pay a guy $600 to take me to catch Red Snapper?
Right.
Regardless of the fact that the other guy has a business license, insurance, captain's license, etc. Like consumers aren't holding themselves accountable or their consumer purchase accountable. At the same time, like, why aren't we looking for that more in those conversations? Yeah, that's decidedly a thing that I have differed on, even on my hunting operation side, is the idea of we're going to talk more about the experience. We're going to talk more about new hunters, and we're going to talk more about conservation, because my hope is we attract clients that care about that. Versus, because I'll be honest with you, man, we kill a lot of ducks. We kill as many ducks as anybody you will find on the duck ranch inside. That's our hunting outfit. We kill a bunch of ducks. But there are days when we don't kill any ducks or very few ducks because you get a weird weather pattern or you get bad rain or you get some kind of system or something. They're still birds with wings. Like, I can't make them exactly land right where they're going to be legally. Illegally, I absolutely could because I can dump porn out there. But that's not even an option. It doesn't even enter our conscious thought. Like, we're trying to do everything by the book and do it the right way because that's how this works. Simple fact is, if you find somebody that kills a billion ducks every day all season long, they've either got a lot of property or I'd start asking some questions, man. Like, it just, but most people don't want to know. Don't ask, don't tell. Mm-hmm. And you can go out there and shoot your ducks and be happy and go home with a good picture for the gram. It's just not a story that we are going to continue to tell the story of the stuff that's going to matter and last. Whether we win or lose doing that, I can't speak to it. Like, I hope we win, but I don't know if we will. But man, I would love to see more organizations being promoted by more outfitting services and everything else, because I'll candidly tell you, you asked if there were others. I don't know if you asked, it was kind of rhetorical, but I will say that on the fishery side, it's really easy to me. If it's fisheries related, it's CCA Florida if you're an angler. It's ASA if you are a American Sport Fish Association, if you are a brand or industry or trying to be in that world. Mm-hmm. They show up every single time there's a meeting. ASA is in that room talking policy. And they always are advocating for access for the lowest common denominator, which I appreciate. Like, as a guy that grew up fishing off a bicycle in a lake, that's a big deal to me. And the other one is Florida Guides Association, which obviously is advocating for guides, but they tend to take I'm on their board. Like, and I wouldn't be on their board if they didn't take the lens of clean water, access and opportunity for Florida Guides Association was one of the groups that got in the conversation on the Skyway Pelican deal last year. And you think, why is a guides organization fighting for this public pier access? And it's because, frankly, where do your clients come from, man? Mm-hmm. Like most people don't go out and book a guide day one. Most people go out and start fishing day one, and then they want to book a guide to advance their skills in fishing. Where do your clients come from? Like, you got to remember where you started, where you came from, where the future guides are going to come from. Like, it's a pretty big deal. So I think hopefully we're starting to take a wide angle lens, but those three groups on the fishery side, like, if you're passionate about fishing, join all three of them. Like, it ain't much to join as a member, but also they are all worth, well, I don't know if you can join ASA unless you're an industry. We join as a nonprofit, like all Florida is a member of ASA. But if you have a tackle company or you make lures in your garage or whatever else, I can encourage you to join them because they do an incredible amount of good work in this state and across the state. You want to catch red snapper, those are the three groups that are going to be in the room. You want to catch snapper in the Atlantic, those are the three groups that are going to be in the room constantly day after day after day after day. So, but, and I appreciate the plug. Like, for us, it's the same kind of deal. Like, we're never going to get the funding. I don't want to ever take money away from an NWTF or a Ducks Unlimited or a Delta. If your heart is in turkeys or your heart is in ducks or your heart is in whatever, you should fund those groups. But it would help if you could fund us too, because we are kind of the connective tissue between so many of those things. And the connective tissue is really where we're going to win or lose. That's why I do what I do, is I think that's where we're going to win or lose, because you can go have success as a fisheries group, or you can go have success as a duck group or a turkey group or a whitetail group, but your success is going to be limited only to the stakeholder group that you have.
That's right.
So in ducks in Florida, you're talking about 14,000 stamps sold last year. That's stamps. That's not hunters. That's stamps. Mm-hmm. Really between two, maybe three organizations. Like, so some people are members of Delta and Ducks. Some people are only members of one or the other. So you've got a finite amount of members that you can get to fund that thing. Part of where All Florida fits in that conversation is we try to bring Delta and Ducks to the conversation when there's a public access opportunity that could increase waterfowl. But we also have to get some funding too, because we're the one that's in the room that sniffed out the opportunity that's going to generate that for them. So it's like this symbiotic thing where we've all got to kind of work together and have each other's backs in those conversations. And I think the future for Florida is bright. You wanted this to be state of the state, right?
Yeah.
I think the future for Florida is bright if we can get our act together. And by that, I mean specifically talking to sportsmen and women listening to this podcast in this world, your friends and family, if we can get our act together, I think we could see a lot of positive movement because we've got big momentum. Heck, dude, getting right to fish and hunt on the ballot in Florida.
Insane.
We did it in 4 months. And I'd be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to International Order of T. Roosevelt, which is an organization I never heard of before. They came out of left field and they funded a lot of this and they helped build the coalition. And like, they have been rock stars from beginning to end on it. And I say end, we're not done yet. But that's one of the most important conservation legislations we'll ever see in our lifetime. If we don't pass that in November, if that doesn't pass in November, it'll never pass again. It'll never happen again. And if it doesn't pass in November, the right to fish and hunt, I shudder to think about the implications for what that means long-term for hunters specifically in our state. I think anglers have a longer runway because there's such an economic benefit there, although I think that will be shaved at by water quality issues and other things over time. I think hunters are in, you know, I'm in my mid-40s. I could see, like, if I live long enough, I could see the end of where we're going in Florida as far as hunting goes. Like, I can see that. And I don't say that fear-mongering. I'll say it lightly. Sure. Why I get out of bed a lot of days is to fight on that stuff because it is so critical, so important. So important to me. It's so important to my family. And I think it's critically important for the fabric of our state's identity moving forward. Man, if we don't pass that in November. So if you're listening to this, you need to be telling everyone you know about that ballot initiative. And if you go to allfla.org/R2FH, the letter R, so write to fish and hunt, but with the number 2 in it, mm-hmm. R2FH. We've got a whole list of talking points out there because people are going to tell you, oh, if we pass this, it's going to undo the net ban or it's going to allow trespassing. None of that's true. Like, we've got the talking points there that kind of cover like what people need to know. Your friends and family, don't fish, don't hunt. We talk about the conservation aspects of it. And also out there, if you go to allfla.org/snailkites, we just released a video where we talk about the importance of hunting in restoring an endangered species, which is we're talking about a benefit to bird watchers, to just the environment, the state of Florida, mm-hmm. based entirely off ranching and hunting. And one of those things by itself doesn't make it happen. Like, if you only had hunting, it doesn't happen. If you only had ranching, it doesn't happen. You have to have both. But because we had both in that place, we were able to, you know, create a massive amount of breeding for this endangered species. Again, that's a talking point. If your friends and family are like, well, we don't really need to have a right to fish and hunt. You absolutely do, because the funding models changed so much in Florida that mm-hmm. the money isn't enough to keep us around. Subsistence isn't enough to keep us around. The only reason to keep us around is we have a right to do it. So it's imperative that we get that done. As a nonprofit, we can't endorse it. We can't tell you how to vote. Mm-hmm. I think you can infer from what I'm saying here how to mm-hmm. do it. But
I'll tell them it's vote in favor of it. Important. Yep. Tell everybody to vote in favor. I think so. Here's the problem we face. I grossly underestimated how good of a dialogue this would be. And so we are right up against the time that I have for today. But I'll just flat out say it. If you aren't summoning every single able body to vote for that and using the tools that Travis has outlined for you to convince those who have trepidations about it, I think you would be remiss. And I really feel like, having looked at that, if you look at the bear hunt and what we're doing to try and get hunting as part of that management plan, the judicial and legislative precedents that this gives us to be able to say we deserve to be in that room, it's everything, guys. It is absolutely everything. And it's a momentum builder. We talk all the time on this podcast about creating momentum in the outdoors and with that, or whatever it is you're trying to do, but then maintaining that, right? We don't have the momentum going yet. And this is that like snowball at the top of the mountain that you push off, and we can just get our momentum behind us. And it just changes so many other organizations in their fights. Travis, dude, I really hated to cut you off there. I looked down at the time and realized we had just like, I put 2 hours on there and we're sitting here right at 2 hours. So, I'm going to do this. I'm going to extend an invite. I would love to do a part two because I want to hear about your family's and your time in Florida, because you said sixth generation, right?
Fifth generation.
Okay. I had fifth and I thought I heard six, so I had my notes wrong. But I want to hear about that, man. I want to hear about the duck hunting you do and kind of, you know, we ate our vegetables this podcast, and maybe we can give them some good stories on the backside. And I know you've got them.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I'd love to do it.
Awesome. So guys, I'm going to go back and pull out all the organizations. I'm going to put all the links, hyperlinks in the show notes here. So if you would be so kind as to go and support those organizations, All Florida and every one of the ones that Travis endorses. I've known him for quite some time. For him to endorse an organization, it's worth your time. I've had a lot of conversations with him about a variety of different organizations and trying to figure out where to put my funding and my time. So I trust him wholeheartedly, and I hope you guys will do the same. So until next time, guys, Travis, thanks again for coming on, and y'all get outside and enjoy the great outdoors.